What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
This year's fall equinox and solar eclipse came with a little something extra, an earthquake. This one, a 4.3 magnitude, centered in Berkeley. We know we've got fault lines. We know a big one is on the way. What is the status of the fault lines? What is possible to prepare for? And how should folks go about doing that? Joining us to discuss is Dr. Angie Lux, a seismologist and project scientist at the Berkeley Seismology Lab, who specializes in earthquake early warning systems using MEMS, so correct me, sensors and machine learning to improve detection and reduce false signals. Good morning, Dr. Lux. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
All right. I haven't done this in a couple of years. It's actually one of my favorite things to cover. For real, I used to be terrified of earthquakes, and then I started covering them, and now I'm not scared anymore. Which people are like, what are you, nutter? So my hope is that our conversation is actually going to help reduce people's anxiety and also help them prepare better, right? So let's start with science. Scientifically, what is an earthquake? What causes them? What's happening when we feel that shaking?
Sure. So an earthquake is what happens when a fault ruptures. And a fault is basically just a crack underground when we have two plates rubbing past each other. So if we step back, the tectonic plates we have big tectonic plates that make up the earth that are always constantly kind of shifting and moving around. And we have bigger cracks, when big plates are stuck together. And then we have smaller cracks when we have kind of fracturing within those plates. And so that makes our big faults, for example, the San Andreas fault. And then we have our smaller faults, such as we have quite a few faults in the Bay Area, smaller faults. That's what makes an earthquake, is when we see those faults that are rupturing.
What did we all experience Monday morning and apparently Monday evening, which I didn't know about until I was preparing for this, that another one hit actually several hours later?
Right. So very early on Monday morning, we had a magnitude 4.3 earthquake right in Berkeley, right over by the Claremont Hotel. It was about 8 kilometers deep, so about 5 miles deep or so. And it was definitely felt. We had people who reported feeling MMI, that's our modified Mercalli intensity scale level 5, which actually we classify that as moderate shaking. So definitely people definitely felt it, especially close to the epicenter. It was definitely an early morning wake up for many people.
I had this experience I want to ask you about with that particular quake. I was in bed actually with my kid. What it felt like, now maybe it's because I was half asleep. It felt like I felt it coming. So I'm in Oakland. It felt like a rolling sensation. So like I knew it was coming, and then the jolt happened. Is that real? Did I make that up in my head? And if that's
no, real, you're that is absolutely real. And I had a similar experience. I'm in Castro Valley, so I'm a little further south. That is very much real. With an earthquake, we have different types of waves of energy that move out from the epicenter. The first wave, the fastest wave, is what we call the P wave. It's a compressional wave. And if you imagine a slinky moving back and forth, that's the compressional wave. And it's kind of like a punch moving outwards. So you probably woke up, as did I, on that P wave arrival. What comes next is a slightly slower wave called the S wave. That's a shear motion. That's more of a side to side or rolling motion. And that comes a little bit later if you're further away. The closer you are to the epicenter, you may not feel those two distinct waves. You just get everything at once. But the further away you are, you may feel first that P wave and then that S wave arrival. And I had a very similar experience where, and a lot of people in fact said, yeah, I was awake when it happened. I was awake when the shaking started. And yeah, they probably woke up on that P wave. And then felt that S wave shaking.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Both me and my daughter. I was neither here nor there. But I'm glad to know that the rolling was happening. My daughter was home from college and she was in the, we both had that experience. Uh-huh. So I then couldn't go back to sleep. I had to get up and see what had happened. And then I knew we were going to be talking about it. And so I logged into the book and people were like, Oh, that was a big one. I knew, however, that wasn't a big one. And it wasn't a big one because my house was cool. So I was like, So can you talk to us a bit about like, what do the different magnitude levels mean and what impacts magnitude levels? And what when we're talking about a big one, what are we actually talking about?
That's a great question. So we have two measurements that I think are really important for people. One is magnitude and the other is intensity. Magnitude refers to the size of the earthquake itself. So how much energy was released during that earthquake. So that's when we say magnitude, for example, 4.3, today, or the previous earthquake that happened in, back in 1868, the largest earthquake we have on record for the Hayward Fault was a magnitude 6.8. So those are, that's the magnitude, the size of the earthquake. Now, another really important measurement is the intensity. That's what people feel. So earlier when I was mentioning that people felt MMI level 5, so level the moderate shaking, that refers to what people experience. If you are right by the epicenter, right near the earthquake, you may feel very strong shaking. But for the same magnitude earthquake, if you are further away, you'll feel lower intensity shaking. So again, we have those two measurements. And one, because some people are like, oh, I felt that earthquake. That was definitely not a 4.3. And it's like, well, no, like it was definitely a magnitude 4.3. That's what our sensors report. That's how we classify that earthquake, the energy that was released. But what you felt may have felt stronger than if you had felt an earthquake previously and you were further away. So I think that's where some confusion comes from as far as like feeling the earthquake and the magnitude. Yes, and again, so the people very closest seem to have registered about a level 5 moderate shaking. That scale goes all the way up, let me just double check, to 12, which is extreme. So to give you a range of what can be experienced during an earthquake. Now, obviously, the extreme level we would only see for very large earthquakes with people very close by. That would be complete destruction, very bad. For large earthquakes on the Hayward Fault, we would definitely expect, for example, if we see another magnitude 7 earthquake on the Hayward Fault, which is definitely something that is possible, we would expect to see some of that stronger shaking, potentially damaging shaking, or an event like that.
The truth is, this is something I discovered in covering this, and that at first made me a little nervous, but then I sort of normalized it. Earthquakes are happening all the time, yeah? Like,
they do.
All the time.
They are happening all the time. In fact, there are some really big earthquakes that happen. And if you go and look at the USGS website, you can see worldwide, there are some really big earthquakes happening. But sometimes they don't get any news coverage because they're happening in a really remote area and nobody's feeling them. So there's that. And then if you look at another map of California and you look at the lower magnitude, you can definitely see if you go down to, you know, magnitude 1, you can see we have these little earthquakes that are happening all the time, and they really highlight our faults because everything is always kind of moving and shifting. And yeah, we're having earthquakes all the time.
I'm looking now, like September 18th, there was a 7.8 in Russia. September 22nd, right, there's a 3.0 in Berkeley. September 20th, there's a 5.7 in Russia. So like, what's happening in Russia? There's a lot of quakes happening in Russia. What's going on? And because, right, like we mean the masses, we hear, oh, Russia, that's far away. But, and I'm going to get into tsunamis with my next guest a little later, but Russia earthquakes impact us too. Like, this is something we should know about and pay attention to, yeah?
Yeah, so there was a very large earthquake. About a month ago, maybe, the Kamchatka earthquake, right? And so that earthquake is going to continue to have aftershocks. And so that the earthquake that you just mentioned was probably an aftershock of that larger earthquake. When there's a really big earthquake, we tend to have also large aftershocks that are going to continue for a while. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, any earthquake, particularly a large one, can affect people even far away. And so it's good to, and it's great for us to learn things from those big earthquakes as well over here.
All right. Walk us through the fault lines here in Northern California. What are we sitting on?
Some of our biggest players, particularly for those of us here in the East Bay, obviously we have the Hayward Fault. That's a big one. As I mentioned, the last major earthquake on that fault line was the magnitude 6.8 earthquake way back in 1868. And we can kind of talk more about that as far as like what to expect. One of the reasons we say that we're overdue for an earthquake is because based on what we know about past ruptures on that fault, so previous earthquakes, we know that they tend to happen about every 150 years or so. And it's been a little more than 150 years. And so just we know that there's going to be another one coming at some point. We have another really major player is the San Andreas Fault, which I think many people know about. And that one goes all the way through San Francisco. And that one was responsible for the 1906 earthquake, very large damaging earthquake. Those are our two main players, I would say, for those of us here in the Bay Area. There are some other smaller faults, as I was mentioning at the beginning. There are some smaller faults that are not capable of such large earthquakes as, for example, the Hayward Fault and the San Andreas Fault.
What about, I got listeners in SoCal that are sitting in traffic listening and like, what about us? What do they have going on down there? And are these fault lines connected?
So the San Andreas Fault actually goes all the way down through from San Francisco, actually further off coast, all the way down through Central California, down through Southern California, down to Mexico. So that is a long fault. And that one has some sections we call locked sections and some sections that we call creeping sections. As you can imagine, the creeping section in kind of along the more central California, we see that that fault seems to be shifting and moving along without a lot of resistance. But up here in the Bay Area and down in Southern California, we know that those are locked sections. And so those sections are capable of a larger earthquake. Definitely San Andreas Fault is an area of concern for a larger earthquake in Southern California.
So scientifically, if San Andreas goes off here, can it trigger SoCal, vice versa?
I cannot speak with certainty whether it would or would not, but I would say that it would not be likely that we would have an earthquake up here that would trigger an earthquake down. Just like the 1906 earthquake that happened on the San Andreas Fault did not trigger a similar earthquake down in Southern California.
Okay. The next question I'm going to ask you is not for fear factor, but it is to get me to the next piece, which is to get people off of their backsides and get prepared. So 7, 8 hits San Andreas, either here or there. What kind of damage are we talking about? Potentially.
We could potentially see some very strong shaking and significant damage for a magnitude 7, especially magnitude 8 earthquake. But particularly magnitude 7 earthquake on one of those earthquakes, on one of those faults, we would expect to see a significant amount of damage and injuries from an earthquake that size.
And what does this mean like in terms of access to clean water, power, things like that, like city services that we sort of wake up and assume are going to be working, now working, and what kind of timeline are we talking about that maybe we might be on our own?
Those are great questions. I traveled to Chile after the magnitude 8.8 earthquake. And during that earthquake, that's a really big earthquake. We can't have one quite that big here because they're different faults. But that was a really large earthquake. And when I went down there about a week later, there was no gas. There was no running water. You could not use the sewer line. So as you can imagine, we could potentially see similar kind of damage here. And what happens is, you know, to be safe, PG&E may turn off, or the electrical companies may turn off the gas because they need to check the lines for leaks. They need to make sure that, you know, with that strong shaking, that none of those lines were damaged. So they may turn off the gas. As far as water, the same thing. Sometimes the pipes break, they have to shut off the water. And so you may be left without water, particularly in areas where the shaking was the strongest. So you're absolutely right to be concerned that there could be no gas or no water following a major earthquake.
According to the USGS, United States Geology Service says there's a 70% chance that one or more quakes of a magnitude 6.7 or larger will occur before the year 2030. When I did this story last time, I was looking at my notes, it said, I was the first I talked about, I said, it's 2022, it's almost 2023. Now it's 2025, it's almost 2026, right? And it really isn't about if, it's about when. I know we don't know when, but we do know it's a when. It's coming. Something is coming. Yeah?
That's right. Yeah. And just to be very clear, nobody can predict earthquakes. I know people online like to say they can't. Nobody can predict earthquakes. Prediction means that you can tell exactly when and exactly where that earthquake's going to happen. We all know there's going to be a big earthquake at some point on one of these major faults in the Bay Area. But we know, I can tell you that. But we don't know when it's going to happen. We do know that it's going to happen at some point. And yeah, just because it's 2025 and that number said by 2030 doesn't necessarily mean the countdown's ticking.
All right.
That's based on statistics, you know. And so, if it doesn't happen by 2030, that doesn't mean it's not going to happen. That just means that it hasn't happened yet.
Okay. Talk to us about Shake Alert. What is it? What advances have been made? How soon can we know what's coming? How can people tap into the system?
Shake Alert is the West Coast Earthquake Early Warning System. It is a system that can detect earthquakes very quickly as they occur and then warn people that they're going to feel shaking. As we mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, there are different types of waves. And sometimes we feel that we can detect the earthquake on that P wave at our stations closest to the earthquake. and then warn people that they're going to feel the S wave shaking, that stronger shaking, before it hits them, ideally. Now, if you're right on top of the epicenter, you may experience shaking before getting an alert because you're closer than our sensors are. It takes us a short amount of time to be able to detect the earthquake. But for people who are a little bit further out, they'll start to receive a warning, ideally prior to shaking. Shake Alert system has been running now for a few years. What it does is it creates the alert message. So our algorithms run, detect the earthquake, estimate the magnitude and location using a very tiny amount of data. We can detect an earthquake using just a second or so from four stations. So that's really quick. And we create that alert message, which then is used by Shake Alert users, one of whom is MyShake. MyShake then delivers the alert to people's phones. So these systems work together in order to detect the earthquake and then to be able to get that warning to people on their phones or other devices.
So if you're someone like me who has MyShake on my phone and you get the warning, what should you do in that moment?
You should get safe. So you should drop, cover, and hold on if possible. We advise people not to go standing doorways. That's outdated advice. I know a lot of people, it's not what we do. We drop, cover, and hold on. And the reason for that is because we've seen time and time again that most injuries during earthquakes are from things falling on people and people trying to run out, people trying to do things when really what they need to do is just get to the ground, cover themselves, and make sure that they're safe and away from falling objects. So again, the advice is to drop, cover, and hold on if you receive that earthquake early warning alert.
Dr. Lux, this is saying, if you stay ready, you ain't got to get ready. So what should people do to be able to move as quickly as one would need to move and be able to deal with no power, no water for, you know, who knows? What do you do? What do you tell your family to do?
Mm-hmm. So ideally when being prepared for an earthquake, if you can plan for a few days or up to 2 weeks, that's ideal because the more that you are self-reliant, the less that you have to worry about getting those resources should the time come. And so one of the biggest things I advise is to get water ready. Make sure you have some clean, fresh water on hand that you can have both for drinking and for anything else that you might need your water for, like pets. You know, not mm-hmm. just about us. Make sure you have some food set aside in a place where it's not going to go bad, some non-perishable items. Make sure that you, there's lists you can see online, but you can put a blanket or some other supplies if you should need to be able to, for whatever reason, if you needed to be living outside of your house for a short period of time, you know, you make sure that you can stay warm. Let's see, water, food, any medications, some flashlights with some batteries, make sure to replace those every year. Again, things that we can do just to make sure that we have those resources so that we're not worried about it when the time comes.
We call that a go bag. Have your go bag ready and accessible.
Right.
And cash. Yes, have cash. ATMs are not going to be working, correct?
That's right. That's a good point. Yeah, cash is another one. Mm-hmm.
All right, Dr. Lux, I want to thank you so much for joining us this morning. And we'll probably have you back. It's something we talk about periodically.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. We've been speaking to Dr. Angie Lux, a seismologist and project scientist at the Berkeley Seismology Lab, who specializes in earthquake early warning systems using MEMS sensors and machine learning to improve detection and reduce false signals.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.